Hi, I'm Brian McCreath, and this is The Answered Question from WCRB in Boston for March 17th, 2017. This is the Third Symphony by Sibelius, as it was performed last Saturday by the Boston Symphony Orchestra and conductor Sakari Oramo. And you can hear Oramo's thoughts about this piece on last week's episode of The Answered Question. That's what comes to you each week on TAQ, insights into the music you hear on the radio in the words of the musicians on stage. In the case of Oramo, his perspectives on Sibelius come from having been born and raised in the composer's homeland of Finland. And he also had interesting things to say about the piano concerto by Busoni, which the BSO played with soloist Kirill Gerstein. You can hear the entire concert this coming Monday night at 8 p.m. on our BSO Encore broadcast. And while the Sibelius is available to hear at our website, classicalwcrb.org, unfortunately, the Busoni isn't due to rights restrictions from the publisher. So, add an event to your calendar. Monday night, March 20th, 8 p.m., Busoni Piano Concerto on 99.5 FM in Boston and streaming at classicalwcrb.org. What is available at our website, along with that Sibelius Third, is an all-Beethoven concert by the Takash Quartet from Rockport Music. That was on WCRB in concert last Sunday, and now you can hear it on demand. As for this weekend, the BSO is playing a program made up of Haydn's Symphony No. 60, called Il Distratto, Debussy's Nocturnes, and Beethoven's 7th Symphony, all with conductor Bernard Haitink. And on Sunday, on WCRB in concert, you'll hear two performances presented by Boston Early Music Festival, starting with Fretwork, the viol consort that performed with soprano Susie LeBlanc last fall, and the other is by the Orlando Consort, the vocal quartet who sang a program of music by Guillaume Dumachaud, which, as you'll hear from Donald Gregg, one of the members of the Orlando Consort, is a composer who plays a huge role in that ensemble's artistic life. Also on the podcast is a conversation with Larry Wolf, the assistant principal double bass in the BSO and the principal double bass at the Boston Pops. He and Ron Della Chiesa got together last summer at Tanglewood. First, though, the Orlando Consort. They're in the process of performing and recording all of the chansons by Machaut. I don't want to give away how huge that project is, and don't worry, Donald Gregg will tell you soon, but it's massive. So when he and I got together right after a sound check for the group's Boston Early Music Festival concert at First Church in Cambridge, I asked him what it is about Machaut that would make them want to take on such a huge project.
We did a recording of Machaut several years back. I mean, he's one of the major figures of medieval music, quite simply. He was born around about 1300, dies in 1377. He's not only a great composer, he's also a poet. So he's contemporary of Chaucer's, and of course the Brits would claim that Chaucer's the greatest. But if you think about it, Machaut not only wrote the poetry, he also wrote the music. So he's a recognised figure, no question. So we recorded a CD of Machaut's music several years back for Deutsche Grammophon. And it's wonderful repertoire. It starts out being slightly daunting, slightly alienating. The harmonic structure and framework is quite different from the 15th century and the 16th century. It's less familiar. Idiomatically, it's strange. He asks you to do strange leaps. He demands a lot vocally. The lower parts have no words, so we have to simply vocalize on an open vowel and so on. So it is very strange. But once you're immersed in that musical world, and of course recording is one of the great ways to do that, because you spend a few days just recording this music, you do find certain beauty to it. So more recently we've started a new relationship with Hyperion Records, and Simon Perry, bless him, philanthropic man that he is, looked at our various suggestions of repertoire to record, and at the bottom we'd simply put something like, and record the entire Machaut chanson, which was just daft suggestion. But he immediately went to it and said, yeah, we should do this. And we're saying, are you sure? He said, how many CDs? Well, we haven't even worked it out yet, but it's going to be 15 or 20 CDs.
That's astounding, 15 or 20 CDs.
Absolutely, it's going to go on, it'll run and run. So we've recorded several so far, and two have been released. Le Voir Dit, which is a narrative poem by Machaut, which we're doing in concert this evening, which links these different songs with readings explaining what the structure of the poem is and why the pieces were written. It's Machaut as an old man writing to a young woman. That's not as perverse as it sounds. It's very much in the tradition of courtly love. It's charming rather than in any way suggestive or lewd. And then the second half features a lot of music from our second CD, which has been released, called The Dart of Love, which moves into motets, not just chansons, and also features some rounds, a couple of rounds, one at a chasse, which is about hunting and so on. So you hear these battle cries as well of people, you know, chasing after hounds and deer and so on, and falcons. They have falcons as well in the chase.
If this is going to take 15 or 20 CDs, I can't imagine it's going to be sort of 15 or 20 CDs of more or less the same thing. What do you anticipate the ensemble will need to do to pivot and calibrate differently as you go through the project? How did Machaut's music evolve, in other words?
It's actually very difficult to talk about an evolution in Machaut's work because he continually revised the work. So it's all of an exceptionally high quality. I mean, you know, you usually have composers split into three eras. You know, their immature years, their mature years, and then the dark years at the end of their life. In fact, Machaut was continually working on his poetry, continually refining, revising these compositions. So you can't talk in those kind of terms. For us, it'll just be a luxury to spend that much time on that one composer. And on the page, sometimes, although they look strange, they don't look too complicated. But of course, when you record them, the more you sing them, the more you discover the intricacies, the kind of things that obviously a music historian, a musicologist would write about and analyze to the nth degree. But we're actually doing that process while performing it.
And there are four of you in the core of the group. Sometimes you expand with others, but how then do you take on the is there a leader for the overall project or for the different chapters of the project?
Well, we're very fortunate insofar as we have very good friends who are music historians, and they are creating the first really modern edition of Machaut in modern notation. There was one done in the 1950s, a famous one, but it really hasn't been done in this kind of detail. So we have these friends, they are friends, musicologists, who are beavering away, going back to the original manuscripts, correcting the kinds of mistakes that were made in the 50s for various reasons, going back to, you know, absolutely pinning it down. So in a sense, they're helping us with providing additions and also ideas as well, ways of structuring the discs so that they're not just endless chansons, something thematic. The second CD, for example, is about Machaut quoting other composers and so on, and also himself being quoted. So there's that sort of link. Angus Smith, my colleague, is responsible often for the programming. So he, again, has a complete thorough spreadsheet of all of Machaut's work. So it's a question of, it's a jigsaw puzzle, really, and it's evolving. We haven't plotted absolutely everyone and so on.
You're just arrived in Boston here at First Church in Cambridge, and just watching you rehearse a little bit, it's clear that you make adjustments as you go. What do you find when you show up in this space? What did you find in rehearsal that you needed to tweak about what you're doing?
Essentially, it's a very live acoustic, and it's very soupy, we would say. It's a beautiful acoustic to sing in, don't get me wrong. But because there is quite a lot of detail in the music, we've had to slow some of the tempi down. Not to any degree that an audience would think, oh, you took that very slowly. It won't be like that. And it's a micro adjustment. And also, perhaps for the reasons of clarity, we'll put a slight front at the beginning of notes and so on. And maybe simply because acoustics respond differently to different frequencies, you know, the lower parts perhaps have to just sing a little bit more. The higher part might have to tuck things in slightly. Maybe sibilance can be toned down a bit. Maybe some of the plosives, the P's and B's and so on, need a bit more effort and a bit more work. Those are the kinds of things that any musician would do in, you know, in a different hall.
So I want to run one little story by you. I saw one time Anonymous 4, and it happened to be that I was like in the second row or something like that. I was right on top of them. And I was stunned because they actually didn't sound alike. And I listened to the recordings. It was a beautiful, beautiful sheen of an all-alike sound. And then I went back into the hall a little bit, and it did blend more. But what I found was, or at least what I think I found, is that the real blend happens with the articulation of the beginning of that note. And you just said that you changed the front of the note. And am I onto something here about how a group develops an ensemble sound, that it's not just the tone, there are other ways that you do it?
Well, there are certainly matching vowel sounds. That makes a big difference. I mean, we spend a lot of time on authentic pronunciation, for better or worse.
Okay.
Not for reasons simply of authenticity, but because it means we're all aiming for exactly the same vowel. So that will also add a certain sort of uniformity to the sound and therefore blend. But actually, one of the things about our group is that our voices are quite distinct. And we don't shy away from that. We don't try to create some sort of more vague ethereal sound. Nothing wrong with that at all. But we think within the form of a collective that individual expressivity is important. And part of that character of the voice needs to come through. So we like those different colours.
Yeah, well, terrific. Don Gregg, thank you for taking a few minutes to talk with me after a kind of busy day, I'm sure.
Thanks very much. Great to be here.
You'll hear from Donald Gregg and the rest of the Orlando Consort this Sunday evening at 7 p.m. on WCRB in Concert with your host, Chris Voss. Also on the broadcast is a gorgeous concert by the British Viol Consort Fretwork with soprano Susie LeBlanc. Tomorrow, the Boston Symphony performs a program of music by Haydn, Debussy, and Beethoven with conductor Bernard Haitink. He's been one of the BSO musicians' favorite conductors for decades, and one of those musicians is assistant principal double bass Larry Wolf, who's also principal in the Boston Pops. Larry got together with my friend and colleague Ron Della Chiesa last summer at Tanglewood at a picnic table behind the Kuzovitsky Music Shed. Here's their conversation.
Larry, I've known you a long time, man. We go way back, and I can't believe that... In 1970,
yeah,
you were the youngest member of the Boston Symphony Orchestra. Is that true?
Well, to be very clear, I was the youngest member at the time. I was 21 when I joined. There have been, Roger Voisin, I believe, was 17. Richie Schur was 19. Joe Hearn was 19. Ronnie Feldman was 19. There have been a few through the years that were younger than I. But, you know, in 1970, I guess that's my claim to fame, the youngest member at that time.
Who hired you?
William Steinberg. Well, to be more specific, William Steinberg was music director at the time, but he was ill. He had pretty serious stomach problems, I remember. But during that audition, he was ill and couldn't make it. That was also a marathon audition year for Boston Symphony Orchestra. There was the class of 70, we call it. There were 11 musicians hired that year, and I'm the only one left standing. But anyway, at that audition... William Steinberg couldn't make it, so his assistant conductor at the time, who was Michael Tilson Thomas, was the man that actually dropped the hammer and hired me. You know, at that time, the audition process would go like, I would play for a committee that was called an advisory committee. So the committee would listen to the player and give the music director the advice, hire this guy. And then, but it would be the music director that would actually say, hired.
So there were two steps. You played for the committee and then the music director?
Yes.
And who would be with William Steinberg?
It would have been William Steinberg, but for his illness. And so it was Michael Thomas, who was a classmate of mine in 1969 at the Tanglewood Music Center.
Oh.
I would have gotten the job anyway, I hope.
That's where we are right now. And backstage, you can hear the crows in the background. Sibelius always said the crows reminded him of critics. I want to talk about your teachers, too, because there were three, I think, primary teachers, right, that you had.
Yes. Well, my first one... William Curtis, well, let me preface that by saying I grew up in Hingham, Massachusetts. I know you're a Quincy man, aren't you? Wasn't there a mayor, Della Chiesa?
That's correct.
My father was
a city councilor, Aldo, and then he went into the service in World War II, and my uncle ran and became mayor, and there's a Della Chiesa school there.
Yes, since I've driven through Quincy so often just to make my way commuting from Hingham to Boston, I've seen the name on plaques. I'm thinking, is that our Ron? In fact, it is our Ron.
Well, there's got to be a Larry Wolf plaque somewhere in Hingham, man, because, you know, you're a big part of the town of Hingham, too. let's get sidetracked.
Oh, didn't we ever.
We're going down that road. But anyway, your three teachers, because they're all fascinating.
Well, having grown up in Hingham, my father, when he realized I had what it takes... or at least he thought I did, he immediately went to Georges Malheur, who was the principal bass of the Boston Symphony, and said, would you take this student? And he said, no, I don't take beginners. And so Georges Malheur said, one of my students, William Curtis, might be the best answer at this point. And William Curtis at that time was registrar of the Berklee School of Music over on the single building on Newbury Street. And probably not too long after it graduated from being the Schillinger House.
Larry Brook.
Yeah. Anyway, so I studied with William Curtis for a couple of years, and at that point, he did probably the biggest thing a teacher could do. He said, Larry, I've taught you all I can. I'm going to recommend you change teachers, and I recommend you change to Leslie Martin. That, I mean, what a huge gesture for a teacher to do that. And so I went to Leslie Martin, who, member of the Boston Symphony, Leslie Tiny Martin. Yes, he was not tiny, so therefore we called him Tiny. And so Leslie Martin taught me for 3 years in high school and 2 years in college, and got me, sort of introduced me to the idea of a career in music, a career in, with an orchestra, playing in an orchestra, and a very convincing and charismatic convincement it was. And I would go down and play at Tiny Martin's studio in Needham, where he lived. I'd commute up from Hingham to Needham, and he had picture after picture on the wall. Tiny with Gene Krupa, Tiny with Ted Weems. Of course, Tiny was a member of the Ted Weems Orchestra, for, quite the jazz player himself. As much as he taught me about the bass, he convinced me that this was a viable and worthwhile life direction.
Tiny had two things going. He was a jazz bassist and he was a classical musician.
Yeah.
Did you ever think of going down the jazz road?
For a while, but I think I combined, in high school, I combined both voices. I was a pretty good jazz player, pretty good, fair improviser, could certainly do a good walking bass line with substitutions and all that. But it just happened that I had a variety of horizons and choices open to me, and it just happened that socially and musically, it all pointed toward orchestral bass. And I suppose I can harken back to Dr. Artin Arslanian, who was a conductor of the Boston Youth Symphony when I was still a member there. And he said, I can still remember looking down at the floor and saying, I think you can put all your eggs in one basket.
Great.
And so I think that was the point at which I said, okay, symphony it is.
Yep.
But Tiny got me well started on the road to symphony. His colleague, John Sant'Ambrogio, was the son of Isabel Sant'Ambrogio, who had the camp Red Fox Music Camp in the 60s. And so I went to Red Fox in the Berkshires in New Marlborough, Massachusetts, in the summer of 1964 and 1965. And they made at least five trips a summer to Tanglewood to the open rehearsals and listened to the Boston Symphony. He said, wow.
Yeah.
Went to the Tanglewood music store, bought music I had no business playing, and made it my business to play it.
Who was the third teacher?
Gary Carr. So what happened in the summer of 1968, I was rehearsing with Gunther Schuller as a Tanglewood Music Center fellow in the West Barn of Tanglewood, and I said, Mr. Schuller, I understand now that you've become the president of NEC, New England Conservatory of Music, and you've just hired Gary Carr to be on the faculty, I'd love to transfer from Boston University, where I studied with Leslie Martin, and study with Gary Carr in my junior year. So he said, okay, I can do that. I have a full scholarship at BU. He says, okay, I can do that.
You must have been pretty good, man, to get it.
Oh, I was good at that time.
Yeah.
Where was I good then?
NEC, full scholarship?
Yeah.
Hey. And I want to talk about the Boston University Tanglewood Institute, which has celebrated 50 years. You gave a wonderful, you wrote a piece
that
they played at Ozawa Hall. It's a standing ovation.
What fun to do. Somehow I got on the map writing bass arrangements for bass ensemble, maybe because I know how to play the bass. And so anyway, I had written some previous arrangements, and when Hilary Respass was beginning to put together the program and the whole mission of the BUTI 50th anniversary concert, they wondered about a bass ensemble, because the BUTI bassists are always so good, just year after year, these high school players who are already middle college level by the time they're juniors in high school. It's pretty scary. And so I decided to write something for them, and then I sat down to write something. I said, no, this is getting too, it's collapsing under its own weight. So I thought, okay, best way to do that, just take a giant step back and say, okay, what do I remember about my 1966 year at which I was a charter member of Boston University Tanglewood Institute? And I came up with just an arranging all the music that I heard that summer. And so in order to fabricate a title, I had to fabricate some repertoire. So I thought, okay, the Koussevitzky Concerto I worked on it that summer, Tanglewood, it all starts with Koussi. Wait, I start my arrangement with Koussi. So it all starts with Koussi,
yep,
which was Koussevitzky's nickname.
Right. great picture of a portrait of him up at Saranac with his double bass.
Oh, yeah. I've posed fearfully in front of that picture.
You did.
Very scary to look up and say, "Oh my God, I'm just a bass player. There's an icon."
You've had a fascinating career, you know, working with your colleagues too in that section. That section jumps out. Yeah. And you just know how to do it, and you do it in Italian, as they say, insieme, together, always.
Yeah. Bass section has been long noted as one of the best sections in the orchestra, and I'm pleased to be on the first stand of that section. And some of my young colleagues say that it really does sound better with me there. I said, "Go on." And they say, "Really?" I said, "How will I know if I'm not there?" "Oh, so what can you do?" But still, yes, it's a wonderful section. I mean, Ed Barker, just an extraordinary principal, organized, focused, just all the attributes that a principal bass and leader should have, he has in abundance. And I'm his second, and I try to do that assistant thing where, of course, he's leading. I will support and compliment what he does. And then every so often I think, wait, you know, I could probably take charge of these next couple of notes. So I'll take charge of him, and he actually, he goes with that. It's a wonderful symbiotic relationship we have together. We're just trading authority back and forth. With ultimately, when you realizing that the ultimate authority resides in his position, it's a wonderful. We're a wonderful team.
Let's talk about the music directors you played under, and so many of them, legends. I mean, you mentioned William Steinberg, who wasn't around that long.
My first season with the Boston Symphony was with William Steinberg, music director. Okay. But one of my most abiding performance memories was of doing Wozzeck in 1969 with Eric Leinsdorf conducting. It was extraordinary. What music. I get goosebumps thinking about it right now. I worked with Leinsdorf only as a TMC fellow. But then 1970, it was William Steinberg, 1972/73, Seiji Ozawa, until James Levine, and then Andres Nelson. So I've seen a few music directors.
Well, plus all the guest conductors that came in. I mean, so many of them. We'd be here all afternoon, right? Oh.
Well, yeah, and people do ask me, okay, what's your favorite piece of music? Who's your favorite conductor? And I say, oh, God. And I don't have a favorite. I mean, boy, do I love Bernard Haitink doing Brahms. Mm-hmm. Oh, my God. Seiji Ozawa, I'll never forget his Turangalila. I'll never forget his Damnation of Faust. William Steinberg, Hindemith. I remember his Hindemith being extraordinary. Michael Thomas, his new music. I remember when Michael came back and did a wonderful Tchaikovsky Manfred Symphony. Mm-hmm. And each one of these conductors has their specific, their deepest voice.
You know, we in the audience and those of us in broadcasting and radio, I think live vicariously through what you do and what the conductors do. We're always up there saying, oh, wow, I was there when that happened. That didn't quite happen for me. But I remember one performance, I think you may have played it. Schulte did a pension fund concert. And it was the Brahms first, and he did the Bartok Concerto for Orchestra. And it might have been in the early 80s. I still have the program for it, but you know, just remembering being in the hall for that particular thing and how fired up, just watching him and how he seemed to pull it out, and the electricity, the fact that he knew Bartok, he was Hungarian. So I saw Joe Silverstein afterward, and he said, I commented to him, I said, wow, I said, that was something. And he said, yeah, it's a pretty good band, isn't it?
Yeah.
And he walked away. So we all have these moments, you know, that carry with us.
And I'm proud to be a member of that pretty good band.
Yeah, you are.
And in fact, I've sort of gotten used to it to the point where I hope I'm not spoiled, but I hope I am all at the same time. It's just an assemblage of musicians. I mean, just the collective wisdom as interpreters, as musicians, as intellects. Oh my goodness. It's a fearsome assemblage of talent and accomplishment. And
Let's move to Pops. Let's move to the legacy of the Pops. Fiedler, Williams, Lockhart. That's kind of like a baseball combination, right?
Yeah. Well, I
Fiedler,
mean,
Fiedler to Williams to Lockhart. You know, it's a double play.
There's plenty of people who call him Arthur Fiedler, of course. there really were. Well, gee, where to start? I mean, Fiedler knew how to sell music. He knew how to sell his image. He put his mug on all sorts of on all sorts of advertisements, but it didn't matter. He got the Pops formula. He's the one that really created that Pops formula that made the Pops the sort of the worldwide sensation that it is now. That with in a Fiedler concert, always made sure that the audience realized, wait, these are world class classically trained musicians. First, if they choose to swing and they choose to rock a little bit further in the concert, that's good. If one of them is chosen to be a soloist during the middle third of a concert, boy, what a revelation to see that, wait, these people leave the ranks and become soloists in their own right, and wait a minute, that just sounded as good as Heifetz.
Yeah.
and that's what we got there on that stage.
Arguably, you know, if you look at Fiedler, 50 years, what a run, going through all eras of recording, 78 RPM, 33 and a third, CD, you could say that Fiedler, in the spectrum of what he did, introduced millions and millions of people to the world of music, not just classical music, but as you said, the crossover things he was doing, the Beatles things, yeah, and all the early stuff.
The vision.
The swing things.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And then we move to John Williams, who was here last night. What a night, by the way. We had typical, so many nights at Tanglewood we've experienced when the weather can just change, man, and all of a sudden they cleared the lawn. First half, Richard Kaufman conducted.
Yeah.
And then John came out 45 minutes later and just knocked everybody out, as he always does out here with his film night.
The man gets a standing ovation before he conducts a note.
Yeah.
And there I am. I mean, I'm his principal bass. He looks up at me and gives me a wink. I say, oh, you want that accent there, don't you? And I play the accent, and he winks at me again. I said, oh, yes, that's what he wanted. Just an extraordinary accomplishment, an extraordinary gentleman. I admire the man so, so much.
Yeah.
Of course, for just a... And now, because I do a little bit of composing, I think to myself... I try to imagine John alone in a room at the piano devising that Harry Potter theme. First of all, getting the shape of it. First of all, thinking, okay, it's going to be a modified jig, slower jig. It's going to be faster than the waltz. But it's also going to have these. He's going to be tweaking notes, just as Mahler did, just not wrong notes, just tweaked notes to give it that little tinge of,
yeah,
of, in other words, just enough of an evil threat, so a child can sense it, but not be scared by it. He's just the perfect pocket that man finds.
I was thinking the same thing last night. There's certain pieces that resonate with me. Princess Leia's theme, you know, da 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 da. You can say, you know, and I'm not a musician, but I say, can you imagine what came into his head when he composed that? Like you say, sitting alone. And you know, if I had composed it, I'm not going to let this go, man. I'm just going to do everything I can. Because I think that's one of the great sweeping romantic themes in the history of film music. Out of Bernard Herrmann, who he greatly admired, by the way. He told me once that he thought Bernard Herrmann's greatest score was Vertigo. He said, listen to the love theme in Vertigo, you know. But what he has done, and put that in perspective into, you know, 100 years from now, right? 150 years from now, they'll be listening to this music. History of cinema.
What if someone were to see the movie without hearing the music, they would hear the music. What if someone were to hear the music without seeing the movie? They would see the movie. This music is just on a deepest level associated with the screen. It's just amazing and stunning, his accomplishments.
And what Keith does, I mean, you know, Aerosmith, I mean, he even took it beyond everybody, right, in terms of what they put in his lap.
Each one of these Pops conductors has their special talent and their special skill and their special identity. And Keith's is the fact that Keith can pick up a microphone and, you know, employ that part of his brain, speak beautifully, intelligently, and gracefully to an audience, put down that microphone and do the same with the baton. If I've been playing, I can't speak in complete sentences for a few minutes. If I've been really concentrating on my playing, and what a talent he has to do that, so that part of a Pops concert is Keith working the crowd, engaging with the crowd. It's absolutely amazing, and Keith has brought his own his own kind of programming to it as well. It's a different Pops format from Fiedler's, but also Keith realizes that all the tried and true Fiedler Pops format is one that has had to have been, if not tweaked, then it has to be retooled somewhat, and Keith has had his own ideas of how it should be done.
I want to talk about your wife, Pamela, because you guys, she's a soprano. She's a delightful person to be around. She's got a great sense of humor. So how do you guys relax at home when you get away from music? What do you do?
Well, I'm speaking to you now early afternoon on a Sunday. This Sunday morning, Pam and I decided to take an old fogies drive. So we took an old fogies drive over to Hinsdale and had breakfast at a little, well, can I say, Aussie Steak and Eggs in Hinsdale. We went over there, sat at the counter, and just had a little bit of a drive. I said, I'm going to take you on a road you've never been on. And I did, and she knows I can do that. And we're both accomplished musicians, very, very ambitious. And that accomplishment and ambition and desire to excel doesn't leave you. And so sometimes, yes, we'll just talk about the weather, about children, about sometimes about music. Pam is on the faculty, voice faculty at Brandeis University. She talks about goings on there. Now on her mind is getting a larger iPad that has all the music embedded in it, so that she can put it up at the piano, so that she doesn't have to carry as much music with her. And so, when that happens, I come in very handy because I'm good with gizmos. And so, maybe we bond through tasks, little things we do together. Sometimes we'll talk, sometimes we'll drive, sometimes we'll work on the same thing together. We've been married 42 years. And
congratulations.
And
little things we do together. That's Sondheim.
And by the way, since my wife has almost a photographic memory for song lyrics, she would have probably sung you the whole song by now. But it's extraordinary. I have the same memory for musical shapes and chord changes.
I was going to say there's so many aspects to Larry Wolfe's musical persona. I don't want to neglect your composing, because you wrote a trumpet concerto.
Yeah.
With Timothy Morrison, one of the great trumpet players anywhere, with John Williams, who conducted it in the Boston Pops.
Yeah. I remember sitting at a little Mexican restaurant with Tim Morrison, thinking, well, do you need a concerto? And he said, sure. That was all. So I started one. And I finished it. I brought it to John. He said, okay. I said, oh, my God. And so, they did it. And I was pretty proud of myself. And I got to say, though, John said, okay, just want to sit this one out and listen to what you wrote? And I said, yes. So I sat at the management table with Billy May.
Billy May,
so one of my... there I am, sitting...
favorite arranger.
Oh, my
The
God.
Billy May.
The Billy May. And I'll never forget it. I'm sitting there listening to my trumpet concerto. John Williams is conducting the Boston Pops Orchestra. Billy May looks at me and gives me a little happy squinchy face, saying he liked what he heard. I'll never forget that. Billy May.
Yeah. You know what Sinatra said about Billy May? He said that having a Billy May arrangement behind you is like having ice water splashed on your face, because Billy has such a great sense of humor, you know, and those things.
Oh, yeah.
He never knew what he was going to do.
Oh, God. Yeah. You always knew you were going to get those wailing saxophones and that low, that wall of brass. Oh, my God, that wall of brass. Just love. And this, and I'll never, that's one, that's another goosebump moment right up there with Wozzeck. Billy May and Alban Berg.
Okay. How about in 1988? At a convention of the International Institute of String Bass Players in L.A., you were a service judge and arranger, and at Disneyland, you conducted, I'm reading from a script now, an ensemble of 80 bass players in his own arrangements of Disney tunes. And I'm a Disney fan. I would let you. Did you record that?
Oh, God, no. No.
Must have meant
this
something.
This is Disney. Nothing is recorded at Disney unless Disney... allows it. But anyway, no, it wasn't recorded, but I'll never forget standing up there on this little makeshift podium and looking down, and I'm conducting Who's Afraid of the Big Bad Wolf?
Aha. Uh-huh.
Yeah, of course it had to be.
W-O-L-F-E.
Well, I'm an E, but the wolf is not. I mean, the Peter and the Wolf version.
So, Larry, here you are. You get all these wonderful years behind you, a life that you love. Doing something that you love, You know, and it, that's so much so fulfilling. So many people don't have that in their lives. You know, they go to work and they're not really happy in what they're doing. What do you envision in the future? You know, more composing, more.
At this point, you know, any great city is comprised of new and old buildings and lots that are in transition. And a great orchestra is no different. I just happen to be the old building and I'm brick and mortar here.
But there's and something extraordinary is happening in the orchestra. We feel it. Brian McCreath, my producer, and Tony Oliott, my engineer. When we do these broadcasts, you know, Andras Nelson's, it just seems, this Shostakovich Grammy Award you just won for the 10th Symphony, and his way of explaining, just for an example, what Shostakovich meant to him as a kid growing up, and what that, the sense of the, what's coming out of the orchestra when he's on the podium, not just Shostakovich, but we are experiencing this kind of renaissance, right?
Oh, absolutely. I've been asked numerous times, how is this orchestra now? And I say, it's never been better. In terms of its internal chemistry, its musical chemistry, its social chemistry, and its relationship with the new music director, it's extraordinary. I don't remember the orchestra ever being in a better place than it is now. And I'm still here. I would contemplate retirement, but I simply, as long as I can do my job and do it to the satisfaction of my young colleagues who are putting out 110%, if I can do the same, and so far they tell me I am, I want to stay and hear what happens next.
Larry Wolf will be on stage again this weekend during our Saturday night live broadcast of the Boston Symphony Orchestra in a program that starts with Haydn's Symphony No. 60, continues with the Nocturnes by Debussy, and finishes up with the 7th Symphony by Beethoven. You can subscribe to The Answered Question at iTunes or through your favorite podcast app, and you'll also find TAQ on WCRB's Facebook, Twitter, and SoundCloud pages. Thank you to Donald Gregg and Larry Wolf, as well as the staffs of the Boston Early Music Festival and the Boston Symphony Orchestra for making these conversations possible. And, of course, thank you to Ron Della Chiesa. I'm Brian McCreath. Thanks for listening.